serving my time. Breaking rocks out here on the chain gang, cause they done convicted me of crime. Hold it steady right there while I hit it. Well, I reckon that ought to get it. Been working and working, but I still got so terribly far to go. I committed crime, Lord, I need it. Crime of being hungry and poor. I left the grocery store, man, breathing when they caught me robbing a store. Hold it steady right there while I hit it. Well, I reckon that ought to get it. Been working and working, but I still got so terribly far to go. I heard the judge say 5 years on chain gang you gonna go. I heard the judge say 5 years of labor. I heard my old man scream, Lord, enough.
Don't send for my sing.
Job. Sing. Ho. Drop your heart, drop your heart, drop your heart, drop your heart. Yeah, God.
Job.
Job.
Good morning and welcome back to Saturday Morning Live. My name is Audrey Wandolo. I'm your host for the Amandla Gorilla Crew. And I'm here today talking about just following back on a conversation I had in the summer of last summer, actually. And one of the interesting things about this conversation was that I was traveling across the U.S. just you know, trying to explore the country. So I went from, met some friends in Winnipeg. So I said, if anybody from Toronto has ever been to Winnipeg, it's one of sort of those extreme cities where it's really hot in the summertime, 40 plus. And then in the wintertime, it can get up to minus 50, 51. And I'm always sort of shocked and amazed because they have also a large African population. So I'm always asking the people from the continent, like, wow, how do you handle this freezing cold? Because in Toronto, I think that we are, you know, we think it's cold, but when you get to Winnipeg, you really sort of know how cold it is. So, we went from Winnipeg and we went down to North Dakota, South Dakota, and really sort of had a chance to, see some of the badlands and stuff. See some of the badlands and also see a bit of the country. One of the great things about sort of taking a road trip and exploring different countries and different cities is that you get a chance to stop in little towns and find out there's people from the African continent, from the diaspora, who are all over different nations who are having similar types of experiences. Now, this conversation I'm going to bring you is, so we went from, we traveled to North Dakota, South Dakota, then went, you know, did some of the tourist stuff, like saw Mount Rushmore. Also, we had a chance to see a place called Wounded Knee. And if you ever have a chance to get down there, Wounded Knee is a First Nations reserve. And there was a big sort of plight and war, and lots of First Nations people had died. And so, again, sort of understanding the history of the First Nations people and then connecting it back. And then from there, we sort of traveled down to Birmingham and, had great conversations with people about some of the things that went on up there and the civil rights movement. But again, it was really just the exploration of, you know, it was a self-discovery piece and trying to see, like, where are people sort of have had these struggles, but also these revolutions that that really sort of have influenced my life as somebody who was born from the continent, who was raised in North America. So I really sort of had a great time. So this conversation I'm about to bring you was from a conversation I had with a young lady from who was living in Lincoln, Nebraska. And how actually we all met was that we were in Lincoln, Nebraska, because we stopped over and it was just sort of a stopover town. And then so we sort of were looking for places to eat and you know, sort of talk to the locals. And we found this restaurant called the African Restaurant. So we sat down with the people and had a conversation about, you know, all things African, all things sort of continental, and just being somebody of African descent in the United States and having that those experiences from that perspective. So the interview sort of just sort of captures, I think, also my own personal journey as somebody who was of African descent living in Canada, some of the same questions I had in terms of coming here as a young female and trying to fit in and trying to reconnect with my culture and also trying to remember, right? Also, you know, trying to remember what it's like to be of African descent, and
that just sort of captures, so, I think, also.
So yeah, so we're about to bring you that in a little bit, and I'm sure some of our listeners sort of had the same journey as a young person, just trying to explore. You come to a new country and you come as an immigrant, and your parents came to sort of give you this life in this different country. So exploring that and taking that journey was a huge piece. So with that, we are going to try to fill in some of that and bring you some of that conversation. But in the meantime, we're going to try to also maybe bring you some music in between, so that you have a chance to sort of reminisce and before we start up on that conversation. So as many of you, your listeners might guess or might know, that I was born in Kenya, and so grew up there. And one of the things also, you know, sort of coming to Toronto, one of the struggles and one of the things that the young lady also talked about was, you know, the struggle to keep your culture, but also the struggle to keep your language, particularly in that. So, but before we get to that conversation and so you have a chance to hear that, we're just going to take a little musical break and get back to our conversation in terms of rediscovering yourself and looking at Nebraska.
Southern trees barren strange fruit, blood on the leaves, and blood at the roots.
This is CKLN 88.1 FM, licensed by the Canadian
Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees, pastoral scene of the gallant South, them big bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, clean and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh, here is a fruit for the crows to pluck,
together for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for the leaves to drop.
Of many different people, customs, and languages. Ishe Oluwa Kole Baje is a song which has been passed down through generations among the Yoruba people of Nigeria, a country located in the western region of Africa. Often sung in church and on happy occasions, these words mean that God's work will never be destroyed.
Kole Baje.
Kellen, I'm your host, Audrey Wandola. We're going to be bringing you the conversation from Lincoln, Nebraska.
We are out and about in Nebraska. Nebraska, Lincoln, Nebraska. Yeah. And we are at a wonderful restaurant called...
That is. Eating some delicious food and chatting with the folks here. Mm-hmm. So with me I have
Zainab Kool.
Zainab.
Yeah.
Zainab, where are you from? Where were you born?
Well, I was born in Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. Originally I'm Sudanese. I grew up in Kenya and also lived in Uganda. So
what brought you to Nebraska?
To America? To Nebraska,
yeah.
Per se.
Okay.
Well, we came with a movement called MIO, which is basically brings refugees from different countries into America. And they try to locate you where you mostly have family. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, we had family in Lincoln.
Yeah.
So, I mean, fortunately or unfortunately, whichever way you put it, we had an uncle here. So they decided, well, let's move them to Lincoln since we know somebody in Lincoln. You know, it's better to go somewhere where you know somebody than to go somewhere you don't know somebody. So
how is, can you describe Lincoln for us?
Lincoln is a small, big town. It's really small size-wise, you know, but it's very diverse as far as there's people here from, you know, all over Africa. There's people here from the Middle East. There's people here from Europe. And then we have the university. It's basically, it's a college town. And then the university basically they host a lot of international students. So you have students from all over the world and refugees and immigrants from all over the world. So you basically get every flavor here in Lincoln. I mean, some people come here like, what do you guys do for fun? Like, yeah. You asked me earlier. Yeah. There's really not a lot to do as far as entertainment-wise. But, you know, people get together. You know, we have a lot of barbecues during the summertime. We have a lot of festivals. They have world festivals. So you get to meet a lot of cultures, people from different cultures. So there's a lot of things that we do together. And it's a family-oriented town. And that's pretty much why a lot of people like it. And a lot of people are migrating to Lincoln, which is weird. We think people would be running away. You know, like leaving because there's not a lot of opportunity. But actually, people are coming in because, you know, to raise kids and to have that family ties, Lincoln is the best place to go because there's not a lot of distractions.
Yeah.
So a lot of people mostly focus on school, family. You don't get in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, which is good.
So yeah, it's a small town. It's a quiet, safe place. Yeah. So I can't really complain much. So.
What about the African population here?
People yeah, like... there's a large African population, especially Sudanese. Mm-hmm. We have a really, really large Sudanese population. And then we have Kenyans, which is, I think, the second largest. And then people from Cameroon. I have a lot of friends from Zambia. We have people from Ethiopia, Somalians. And just pretty much a wide variety of Africans.
So when you came, in terms of retaining your culture and connecting back with other people from Africa, mm-hmm. of African descent, was it difficult or was it, how was that transition for you?
Well, actually, that's a good question. I came here when I was 12. So I was kind of in that, you know, that teen years. And yet you had, well, coming here was actually, it was kind of confusing at first because you come here, you go to middle school. You know, and you're 12. So in school, there's this whole system. It's a whole different world out there.
Yeah.
You come home and your parents expect you to maintain your culture, to maintain your, you know, basically our morals and our ethics and where we come from. For example, one time I was in school, and then when a teacher talks to me, you know, traditionally, when an older person talks to you, you don't look at them in the eye. And so it's kind of disrespectful. So I was in class, and the teacher was talking to me, and I couldn't look at her in the eye. And she tells me that that's disrespectful, or it shows that I'm not paying attention, or I don't care for what she says. So I'm like, oh, okay. And then I go home, and my mom's yelling at me or talking to me, and I'm looking at her in the eye, and she's like, you know, she would be like, you're being disrespectful. So I'm like, okay. You know? Okay, what am I supposed to do? So basically, as an African, you have to, you know when to switch from that. You know, coming to school, we have to act differently than we would when we're home, or just different things, like, you know, being out in the public with people. You know, if you're young, you want to be cool, you want to be with your friends, you want to talk a certain way, again, peer pressure, you know. So that was kind of a burden, because then you're torn between two different cultures and you don't know which way to go.
Yeah.
And it's kind of difficult too, because nobody can really understand or relate to the youth at the time. So like, growing up, a lot of youth here get in trouble mm-hmm. because we try to maintain our culture at the same time, try to fit in to the American society, mm-hmm. and it's kind of difficult for them. Mm-hmm. So a lot of them usually, at first, we kind of basically just stay away from our own tradition
mm-hmm.
to try to learn this new tradition that we like. That, I mean, you know, it's more comfortable for us.
'Cause,
like, you know, for example, we want to hang out with friends, we want to do this. As a female, also, it's a lot harder because you expect to do certain things at certain times and not certain things at certain times.
Mm-hmm.
So we come here and there's a whole lot of things going on. So basically it's just this, you're being torn between two different cultures.
Yeah.
And you come to school, your teachers don't understand you, or they don't understand where you come from. You go home, your parents don't really understand you. Because for our parents, it's a lot easier for them, but they don't really understand what we go through in a daily basis. So a lot of youth kind of steer away from the tradition once in a while. But after all, we are... we're close to the community as far as, you know, we have a lot of Sudanese friends. If you're Sudanese, you know a lot of Sudanese. We kind of hang out together.
Yeah.
And you have American friends. And what I like about Lincoln also, it's so cool that we bring all that culture together and try to learn from each other. Like when I was in high school, we had a group. We had a multicultural group. I had a friend from Colombia, Russia, Germany, Vietnam. Kosovo, and that was the Sudanese one.
Yeah.
So we'd all sit together. You know, that's really neat. Yeah. That's really neat. And that's in high school. But then when you get to college, it's a different, it's a different lifestyle.
So have you thought about going back to the continent? Going?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I would love to go back.
Yeah.
I really would. I feel that I can benefit so much more back home than I can here. Yeah. If I live in America, basically we're benefiting myself. But I feel like I have a creative cause, you know.
Yeah.
Not a lot of people got the opportunity to come to America and to get the education that they have here. So I feel like, you know, I am blessed to come here and get this opportunity, and I would like to go back home and help, definitely.
And in terms of integrating and being in Lincoln, is it a diverse community? Was it easy? Did you experience sort of racism here when you first came?
Well, yeah, of course. You know what I mean? I mean, there's all, I mean, as far as racism goes, there's always racist people. But Lincoln in per se, there's a lot of nice people. They might not necessarily like you or anything, but they wouldn't be disrespectful directly to you.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't come to you and be like, you know, say the N-word to you and stuff like that. And actually what's funny is I didn't even know the N-word existed until I was in America. And then I was in class, I remember it was my 7th grade class. It was actually an English class. And I was sitting in my row. You know, this is, what, my 3rd month in America, in the American school system. So I speak English pretty well when I got here. And most people were confused, like, what? You came from Africa? You speak English? Yeah.
We do that.
Yeah, thank you, you know. So I'm sitting in class. And I guess there was something that happened during break with between a white girl and an African-American female. And so they were chatting about that. And I was sitting in the classroom, and she was sitting in front of me, and she's an African-American female. And she turns to me and she says, so Zainab, you know, you being African and all, what would you do if somebody ever called you the N-word? You know, and I look around. I've heard the word before.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't know what it means. So I'm in class, and I go like, what is the N-word? And I swear to God, it was like a freeze moment where the whole class just froze, even the teacher, and turned around and looked at me like, you're black and you don't know what that means. Yeah, because in Africa, we don't have those terminologies. So the whole class was frozen looking at me like, are you kidding me? You know, and I think I was the darkest one in the class also. And not to know, you know, the N-word, what it meant was, and to me, I felt kind of lost there for a minute because I was like, everybody's expression was like, did I say a bad word or something? Like, because I really didn't know what it meant. So the girl looks at me like, you're kidding me, right? I'm like, no, what does it mean? And then she goes like, you. I go, what do you mean you? She goes like, that's what they used to call black people here. Simple as that. And then it kind of made me realize, oh, okay. And I think that was kind of the point where it made me kind of think about my race and made me feel a lot different. Because before, I knew there was racism and I knew there was people who don't like each other. Like back home, we have tribalism, which is, it's basically, you know, I just don't like you because my tribe doesn't like your tribe. It's not because I don't like you because of your color or I don't like you because of this. It was just little things. It wasn't really, you know, engraved in us to hate each other like that or to think less of any other person because of their color, you know. But coming here, and ever since that day, I did start to notice the racial stuff that was happening. Before, I just kind of like, that person is mean. You know, that's what I would think. I'd be like, she's a mean person. Maybe they're not just doing it to me because I'm different. I never really thought of being different as different. Because in Kenya, you know, we have every race. You know, we have Europeans, we have Indians, we have Americans. And we kind of all grew up together. And if you're being from Europe or from a different country and you come to Africa, of course you're not going to be a racist person. Being in Kenya especially. So we didn't really have that racial barrier between everybody. Mm-hmm. So everybody got along very well. I mean, there might be some few incidents, but it wasn't really a big deal. Not like it's here, you know? And then after that, I started, picking up on things. And the older I get, the more I start to realize, wow, this is a bigger deal than I thought. Because I remember when I was 12, I didn't even have time for that stuff, you know? I had so many other things to think about than to worry about, oh, does this person really judge me because of my color? But then when you grow up more, you have more responsibilities, like looking for a job, trying to get a car, trying to make new friends, you know? And then you start to realize a lot more of the racial things. And then you start to be like, wow, you know. And to me, I don't really let racial, like racist people or anything like that affect me personally. Because, again, it wasn't embedded in me. I wasn't raised with it. I personally don't care. If you don't like me because of my color, then you're the one with the problem. Not me. Like, seriously, I feel more sorry for you. And to me, you know, the more I grow up, I'm like, okay. It kind of makes me look less down on, like, well, you know how they say this racial world. America, compared to the rest of the world, is the least racist place in the world. Because if you go to Japan, if you go to Germany, if you go to Europe especially, they're a lot more upfront with it, you know? But here they kind of cover it up, they sugarcoat it, and they kind of let you know, but not really, you know? So in a way, to me, it's like, it's just a waste of my time. It's ignorance, you know, it's lack of, I mean, and to me, it's like, Americans are supposed to be the most educated people in the world. Then if you're educated enough, you should know that, really, there's no difference between me and you. Now, if I had a third eye, or I bled the wrong color or something, then yeah, by all means, I could go ahead. But we're all the same. The only thing is my difference. My pigment is basically the difference, you know? So to me, when they do that, I never let it affect me. I'm just like, oh, you're the one with the problem. Yeah.
What does it mean to you when people say African-American, since you are born in Africa, mm-hmm. and you're also American. And is there a different definition for you than the sort of the stereotypical, this is African-American, this is the history of African-American, or like, what does it mean for you being a person of African descent,
mm-hmm.
living in America, who, you know, sort of taking on this identity? Because I'm sure when people say African-American, they also mean, you know, about this history.
To me, I've never really considered myself African-American. Mm-hmm. I've always said I'm African. You know, no matter what, you ask me, I'm African, because I am African, you know, it's engraved in me, you can see it in me. Even if I'm in a room full of African-American, they can pick me out. That's an African girl, you know, because of how I am, because of how I act, and because of, it's just engraved in me, you know, everything about me is African. So, when I'm in a room, I never really see it as African-American, but unless I was born here, and my family were born here, and my ancestors were born here, then I can say I'm African-American. And most people are like, well, aren't you a citizen? I'm like, yeah, I'm a citizen, but that doesn't necessarily make me American. You know?
Yeah.
I just never really thought much about it.
So there's a distinction between like somebody who's African, mm-hmm. and then somebody
you
who's African.
You have been listening to a conversation that we had, that I took when I was taking a journey through the United States, talking to a young lady, and also a couple of people in the Lincoln, Nebraska, just about their experiences being African or African descent in Lincoln, Nebraska. So with that, we're going to sign off from Anmandla and send you back to Saturday Morning Live, the rest of Saturday Morning Live here on CKLN 88.1. We're live on the web. And we're also going to be joined by the Gerald Horn Report. So with that, we're going to take a little musical interlude and say goodbye from the Mandla.
We are out. and about.
And you are listening to CKLN. This is Saturday Morning Live. And we're getting ready to go to Dr. Gerald Horn. And Dr. Horn, are you there?
Yes, sir.
How are you doing today?
Oh, I'm okay. How are things at the station?
Not too bad. We are running and up and running, and people are calling, so we have some listeners on the internet. Once again, I have Melinda Francis in the studio with me, and I wanted to, let her ask the first question and see which way we go. But I guess before we begin, I wanted to get you to talk about your current books. I was listening to you on Margaret Prescott, and I know that the book about the black soldiers in the British Empire, that's not ready. But I think people would like to hear, you know, what you have coming off of the assembly line.
Well, I think it's timely in light of this so-called royal wedding that takes place within days, which has, as you know, been getting a tidal wave of press coverage all over the world. And it's raised rather searching questions about the nature of the monarchy. It's very curious that London and Washington often complain about heads of state serving too long in their estimation. For example, Mr. Gaddafi in Tripoli in his 42nd or 43rd year. But what's striking is that the head of state in Britain is basically a family business that's passed down from generation to generation, and has lasted for hundreds of years, and yet you rarely hear that kind of critique on this side of the Atlantic. And I think that's a proper backdrop to discuss this book that I have coming out in a few months, Negro Comrades of the Crown, African Americans in the British Empire Fight the United States Before Emancipation. Now, this book is to be published by New York University Press, and you may consider it curious that this book has such a title, given what I just said a moment or two ago. That is to say that the revolt against British rule in North America that led to the formation of the United States in 1776 can be seen as a repudiation of monarchy and can be seen, quite frankly, as a step forward for humanity and against the idea that the position of head of state is basically a family business. And given that, some listeners may wonder, well, then, why were the U.S. Negroes fighting alongside London against this so-called advanced idea of republicanism? And there hangs a tale, because, quite frankly, the point is that even though republicanism was seen as a step forward for humanity generally, as against monarchy, the way that republicanism was executed on this side of the Atlantic basically was found monumentally unattractive and unappealing. Daniel O'Connell, the great Irish patriot of the 19th century, was notorious for saying, and he shared the sentiments of many, when he suggested that the semi-feudal aristocracy of London was basically supplanted in the United States by the aristocracy of skin color. And he found that very difficult to take seriously. And so did the Africans, who were the major victim of republicanism. As I've noted before in these airwaves, when you had a republican revolt, so-called, in 1837, 1838, centered in the city in what is now called Toronto, it was the Africans who basically rose up on behalf of the crown, because from their point of view, republicanism meant racism on steroids. And given their experience with the United States of America, I don't think that sentiment was misplaced at all. It's very interesting as well that in the 20th century, you have many people on this side of the Atlantic who say socialism might be a good idea, but the way it was executed, particularly in Moscow, basically discredited that idea.
Right.
And yet, if you look at republicanism, they do not take the next step and say republicanism versus monarchy, republicanism might be a good idea, but the way it was executed on this side of the Atlantic was basically not a good idea. That's the next step, and that's what I'll be arguing in my next book, Negro Comrades of the Crown.
Before I let Melissa jump in here with both feet and hands, I wanted to ask you another question about republics. Is there a difference between a people's republic and a republic? Now, we had People's Republic of China. We had the People's Republic. I think there's a People's Republic in North Korea. We once had the People's Republic of the Congo. And we also have the People's Republic of Brooklyn. What are your thoughts on the People's Republic versus the American-style republic?
Well, I think the concept of a people's republic is meant to signify that what is at play is not a bourgeois republic, which is what you have in the United States. By bourgeois republic, I mean that you have a litany of rights, but your ability to vindicate those rights depends on how much money is in your pocket. I mean, for example, you have the right to a trial in these bourgeois republics as a criminal defendant. But if you don't have money to hire a lawyer, you effectively do not have a right to a trial. So basically, the idea of a people's republic is meant to signify something deeper, something more profound, in fact. And I think that generally that has been the case with regard to the proclamations of these people's republics.
All right. Thank you.
Is anybody on the line?
Okay.
Can
my
you
mic,
hear?
Yeah, my mic wasn't on. Hi, Dr. Horn. Can you comment on the situation in Libya and Obama and his drones, the dropping? Did you hear me? Yeah.
Libya, as you know, is going into the second month of a NATO-sponsored war. The war has basically devolved into a stalemate by all reasonable estimations. The latest developments have been that the Western European countries, particularly France, are sending so-called advisors to the front line. This is a familiar pattern. Advisors usually are the first step for the dispatching of military troops, boots on the ground, which supposedly have been sworn off by the North Atlantic powers. Mr. Obama is still showing his hesitation by sending drones. These are these pilotless aircraft that can be operated, quite frankly, from your living room in Toronto, Norman. And the film Body of Lies with Russell Crowe and Leonardo DiCaprio recently released gives an idea of how this operates. That is to say, Leonardo DiCaprio is the advisor on the ground in Iraq, and Russell Crowe is in his living room in Virginia, basically giving directions as to, Leonardo DiCaprio sending coordinates back to Russell Crowe in Virginia, who then launches these drone strikes from his living room in Virginia. The ideal on the part of the United States is that they have skepticism of the intention, the ultimate intentions of these rebels. They don't want to put advanced weaponry in their hands, and they're not doing that with drones. The technology still remains firmly in the hands of U.S. operatives. But what this does bespeak, of course, is the fact that this is not going very well. A stalemate is not what was intended. In fact, what was intended was the quick and rapid routing of the Gaddafi forces, but now we know it's not going to be quick. We also now know that Mr. Gaddafi has considerable gold stocks. And these gold stocks, unlike the gold stocks of other countries, are not in Switzerland. They're not in Fort Knox, Kentucky. They're in Tripoli. And even if he is routed from Tripoli, which seems doubtful, but let's speculate, it is now suggested that he could retreat into the interior of the country, where he has even more support in Tripoli, and with the help of his gold stocks can continue to buy weapons and can continue to pay soldiers, for that matter. And given the fact that the price of gold is going through the roof as the price of the dollar, the value of the dollar, goes through the floor, those gold stocks are going to be worth even more. And so this conflict in Libya could be going on indefinitely. And quite frankly, I'd say that Washington and the North Atlantic powers, including Canada, are really going to have to look for a way out of this scenario, although I don't really see what the way out is for them, because they got in too deeply from day one, and now I don't think that there's a rescue for them.
Could I add that I was listening to CBC last night, and the CBC is reporting that Gaddafi, that there's some of the elements in Muammar Gaddafi's army are don't like the way the situation is going, that they want to go in and do a Dessalines. When I say a Dessalines, the way Dessalines is portrayed as this bloodthirsty general who just wanted to chop off heads. And I'm not saying that that was actually Dessalines' role, but they are saying that there's a split within the military in Libya, and that the military wants to basically just decimate the rebels in the other part of Libya. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, let's have some historical perspective. Just yesterday, I was able to screen a 20-year-old film called Lion of the Desert. It's a depiction of Omar Mukhtar, a great national hero of Libya, who fought a two-decades-long struggle against Italian colonialism from around 1911 to 1931, when he was finally captured and hung until the last breath had expired from his body. What was interesting about this film, and also about the struggle which it depicts, is the bloody nature of this struggle. Not only were there mass hangings, not only was Libya the site of the first aerial bombing taking place at the beginning of the struggle in 1911, when the airplane, which supposedly had been invented in North Carolina in 1903, but quite frankly had been invented in Brazil a few years earlier, but an airplane was used in Libya, and bombs were dropped from the airplane against defenseless individuals. Then there was the use of poison gas as well, which, of course, was a violation of all international conventions that we are aware of. And so, given that kind of historical context, it does not surprise me at all that there are those in Libya who are suggesting that more bloodlust is necessary. I think that the Libyan example, which it was thought to be following in the footsteps of Tunisia and Egypt, basically did not, insofar as what you had in Libya was an armed insurrection, unlike Egypt and Tunisia. And in fact, if I may segue, apparently that is also at play in Syria. Syria, as you know, was the scene of dozens of killings yesterday by the authorities. But what's different about Syria and unites it with Libya is, number one, the fact that some of the protesters have engaged in armed revolt. Number two, that the U.S. authorities and the Canadian authorities are no friends of the Assad regime in Damascus and would like to see it go. And not only that, but the dislodging of the regime in Syria could be very complicating for the proposed proclamation of Palestinian independence, which is supposed to take place at the United Nations in September when the General Assembly convenes. And we had thought that this was going to be a major turning point in history. But if the Assad regime is dislodged, it could really throw the whole region into chaos. And then I should also add that Syria is a very close ally of Iran. Perhaps Iran's closest ally in the region is through Syria. Then Iran is able to reach out to Hezbollah in Lebanon, for example, and even to a degree to Hamas in Palestine. What's interesting is that if you watch Press TV, which I recommend, which is the Iranian TV station in English that you can find on the Internet, you'll find that there is a lot of nervousness about these events in Syria. But to come back full circle, what you'll also find on Press TV is that there is a lot of cheerleading on behalf of the rebels in Libya. And I find this rather baffling to a degree, because it's clear to me, at least, that the uprising in Libya, to a certain degree, is a dress rehearsal for a planned uprising in Iran. Therefore, while the Iranians are cheering on this revolt in Libya, is quite befuddling. But in any case, that is the case, and it does suggest how these events in North Africa and in West Asia have really reshuffled the deck and has led to a certain amount of confusion.
You're listening to Saturday Morning Live. My name is Norman Otis Richmond. You're listening to Saturday Morning Live on www.ckln.fm, and we want you to call your friends, neighbors, and even your enemies and let them know that Saturday Morning Live is online. And I'm in the studio with Melissa Francis, and she's going to ask the next question.
Yes, maybe we should move over to the coast and comment on the Ivory Coast situation.
Yes, before we do get to the Ivory Coast, let me mention another point about North Africa, and that is the ramifications regionally. Algeria, you may recall, that when the Arab League voted some weeks ago for this intervention in Libya, the Algerians abstained. The Algerians, I think it's fair to say, are rather nervous about what's going on in the their next-door neighbor, that is to say, Libya. And Algerians have bad memories of French bombing campaigns in the late 1950s that led to the deaths of civilians. The Algerians are very nervous when the French began, as they are doing now, to throw their weight around in the region, because that usually means bad news for Algeria. And so I think that as this conflict in North Africa unfolds, you're going to have to keep a close eye on what's going on in Algiers, because even though they may not extend direct military support to the Tripoli regime, do not be surprised if there are various indirect means of support, not least because their neighbor on the other side of Algeria, I'm speaking of Morocco, has basically endorsed the revolt, is on the same side as France. And on the other hand, Morocco itself is having internal eruptions, based not least upon the fact that the king of that desperately poor country happens to be one of the richest men in the world and wants to maintain his fortune. Now, moving further south to Cote d'Ivoire, it seems that the situation there has yet to stabilize. Now, we do know that Mr. Laurent Gbagbo, the past president who challenged the November 2010 election before being dislodged by French paratroopers about a week or so ago, Mr. Gbagbo is now under tension. What's going to happen to him is something of a mystery. I dare say that the current regime in Ivory Coast, Cote d'Ivoire, would like to see him dispatched forthwith to The Hague to stand trial for so-called and alleged human rights violation and war crimes. But if they open that door to an indictment of Mr. Gbagbo, it seems to me that will also open the door to an investigation of alleged war crimes committed by forces tied very closely to the current regime in Cote d'Ivoire under Alassane Ouattara, who has emerged as the new president of that beleaguered country. There have also been reports this past week in Cote d'Ivoire of fighting of the military variety between various armed factions in the armed forces. This is a reflection of the fact that the vote in November 2010 was hotly disputed. There was roughly a 50-50 divide in the country. The United Nations said it was more like 54-46. But in any case, it is a country that's split among many lines, not only the electoral lines, but also religious lines, that is to say a heavily Muslim north and a less heavily Muslim south. The same kind of divide you see in Nigeria, where you saw President Goodluck Jonathan, who's from the South, re-elected, but receiving did not receive a majority in the north of the country, the heavily Muslim regions. And in those regions, you have seen outbreaks of violence directed against government entities and directed against supporters of Mr. Johnson. This was nothing new for Nigeria. We all recall the rather unfortunate Nigerian civil war of some decades ago. Let us hope they do not go down that path once more.
You're listening to CKLN. Now we wanted to discuss, I guess, the real hot potato, the Canadian elections. And I have real mixed feelings about this this election because I am not a fan of Michael Inatieth, but a lot of my friends are really afraid because, you know, there's a lot of talk about strategic voting to keep the Harper government from winning. But at the same time, Jack Layton and the NDP are doing quite well in the polls nationally and especially in Quebec. And there is a sentiment that says that Jack Layton, they support him as a great leader, but he's with the wrong party. And that is the situation here. Now, we're going to elections on May the 2nd, and it looks like Michael Inatieth is he's not really carrying his weight. I know that he is. People don't really trust him because of you know, they see him as the Massachusetts candidate. I think you coined that phrase based around the Manchurian candidate. He was parachuted into office here in Toronto. He took over Jean Augustine's riding. Jean Augustine, an African woman born in Grenada, who came here and worked her way up. Used to be in Chrétien's government. She did a lot of great things, but they basically took her position and gave it to Michael Inatieth. And there are still a lot of people who have problems with that. But so Michael Inatieth is looking very, as you would say, very curious in terms of these elections. How does it look from your reading down south of the border?
Well, I would say this. If Jack Layton and his New Democratic Party dislodges the Liberals under Mr. Inatieth as the number two party in Canada, this would be tantamount to a political earthquake. It would get global attention, worldwide attention, because Canada would basically be going against the grain, that is to say, going contrary to where other leading capitalist countries have been going of late. After all, the Tories prevailed in London. Mr. Sarkozy, a conservative, is in office in Paris. Angela Merkel, a conservative, a Christian Democrat, is in office in Berlin. The elections in Finland, once thought to be a social democratic bastion. Basically, a xenophobic right-wing populist party has done quite well, and it's disrupting attempts by the Eurozone to bail out Portugal and Ireland. And so the trend in the advanced capitalist countries has not been to the left. If Mr. Layton prevails, this means that Canada is in the vanguard. This means that Canada may be auguring a new trend in advanced capitalist countries, a new trend which I have to say, quite frankly, I would welcome. The only question I have is that I've been reading the polls that suggest that the NDP could supplant the Liberals as the number two party. This leads to a twofold question for either one of you. Do the polls suggest that with such a result that the party of Mr. Harper would win an outright majority? That's question number one. And if the Liberals do become the number three party and the NDP becomes the number two party, what are the other repercussions and ramifications of that electoral development?
Did you want to deal with that, Melissa? Melinda.
Well, in my mind, the the NDP, I've kind of lost confidence in them, and I've seen them kind of develop. I see them just, their policies are just as, are just like the Liberals. So it makes sense that they're kind of taking over from the Liberals. So I'm at a point right now where this is the first time where I'm even thinking of boycotting the election. But
my question question number one, do the polls suggest that the Mr. Harper's party will get a majority? That's the question.
Yes, they do.
Yeah.
Yeah, they are saying that Harper has about 46%, I believe. Yeah. And
and
I think that is very dangerous.
If Mr. Harper gets a majority, can that majority be effectively counterbalanced by a block of NDP parliamentarians, Liberal parliamentarians, Quebec Bloc parliamentarians, and others? In other words, would they have 54%? And if so, without going into the weeds of parliamentary law, if they have 54%, why can't they go to the government, Governor General, and ask to form a new government?
I hope they can. I hope they can, because I think I'm sounding not like a conservative, but I think we need to block Harper by any means necessary. I'm hoping that they can. Can get rid of Harper, but at the same time, in order for the NDP to do that, they have definitely moved to the right. Even internationally, we know that they moved to the right, but I mean, Jack Layton is talking about the more police, I guess. So what I'm saying is that we need to critically support the NDP, but we have to hold their feet to the fire.
But the thing is, my question is that, I mean, you're talking about a minority government and sort of a coalition. They've had that for the past 6 years, and there hasn't been any sort of coming together and blocking Harper. They've just been in kind of holding mode. So my question is, even if that was to happen, is that even going to be effective? Like, you get what I'm saying? Like,
well, Canada's had more elections. I mean, they seem to have an election in Canada every year or two. And it seems to me that that bespeaks a certain kind of breakdown in Ottawa. I'm not sure if it bespeaks any sort of conciliation with the Tory party, wouldn't you say?
Well, the Tories have, first of all, we have to realize there's a lot of apathy. I think that the last election, 2008, you had the lowest turnout in the history of this country. That's one thing that we have to take into consideration. But I disagree with Melinda in terms of, I think if Harper gets a majority, I think he could really, it would be a terrible thing personally, I think.
No, I agree with you, but at the same time, even when they have a minority, they don't they don't join together and actually create an opposition. So he's been ruling as a majority all this time. So I don't know. I'm like, maybe I'm just saying that the opposition parties need to get some, you know, balls or something. I don't know.
Well, I think that our good friend Michael Anatieth is the problem. I think the Liberal Party is because they seem to be the ones that really don't want to really cooperate with the NDP.
This is true. Yes, I agree.
So, is there anything else you'd like to add, my good friend, Mr. Horn?
Well, no. Welcome to your new dispensation, and wish us well.
And we will be back with you next week. And thanks to Melinda, we have sound. Is that SoundCloud?
Yeah, SoundCloud. Yeah.
SoundCloud.
Podcasting.
I guess we'll be putting up this part of the show, I guess,
Right away.
Yep. Sounds good.
All right, my good friend, we're getting ready to talk about retirees in the auto industry. We're going to have on General Gordon Baker from Detroit and Mr. Bill Devine, who is a retired auto worker from General Motors, the van plant in Scarborough. He retired in 1995. He was in the CAW. So are you listening online?
Yes, sir.
All right. So we will see you in the whirlwind, and thank you for contributing today.
Yes, thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. And we have been listening to Dr. Gerald Horn.
Somebody would come and ease my troubling mind. Oh, yes, I do. Why won't somebody come and ease my troubling mind? Sure wish somebody would come and ease my troubling mind. Oh, yes, I do. I wish my baby would come and tell me everything's all right. My baby would come and tell me everything is still alright. Oh, yes, I do. They tell me when you tell somebody your troubles, trouble fly away from you. I'm looking for somebody I can tell my troubles to. Why won't somebody come and ease my troubling mind?